Hey everyone, it's Maya, and you're listening to Right Back At You.
It's after midnight and she's on your phone. You are listening to Right Back At You, the Noughties Pop Music Podcast with myself, Joel Babington and David Lim. Today we have a very special guest on the show with us. We are truly honoured to be speaking with a Grammy Award winning multi-platinum artist. She is an all-round entertainer and pop culture legend, the complete package. She sings, she dances, she writes, she produces, she acts, and even more impressively, she is a real boss behind the scenes and has thrived in this music industry for over 20 years. We have Maya with us today. Maya, how are you doing?
Hey guys, I'm doing great. What about you?
Really great. This is such an honor. Like, honestly, like, high school me would be freaking out right now. Like, the amount of times I listened to the Mood Ring album and just absolutely rinsed it. Like, this is, you cannot tell me at this in 2020 that we would be speaking. Like, that is wild. So I'm absolutely freaking out right now.
Amazing. That's so cool to hear. Thank you guys for having me today.
Thank you so much for your time today. We have loads we want to talk to you about. So without further ado, let's get into it. Let's take it all the way back to your debut in 1998.
The mid to late 90s was such an amazing time for R&B music. Like, I think especially for us kids that grew up watching MTV, and that was our first exposure to pop culture, you know, the music videos, the fashion, the choreography. Like, that was the time you debuted with your first single. But we wanted to kind of go back a little bit and just explore, how did you get your deal? Because you were signed at 15.
I was signed. Actually, I waited to sign a contract until I was 18 years old. I couldn't actually legally sign with the record label in my area, which was the independent production team and label that I signed to out of Washington, D.C. But we worked together and met when I was 16. In my living room after school one day, they came over to audition because they received a resume, a long resume of all of these performances that I'd done. But they wanted to also hear me sing live in addition to the demo tape that my dad gave them. And my dad was in the local scene in music as a performer for decades. He even put some of his own vinyl out and got some radio play regionally here. But I mean, I grew up around music. It was in my blood. It's something that I always did, but I was a child of the arts for years, and I was in gospel choir, orchestra, was the dance team captain at school. So I guess I'd been preparing for this. I wanted to pursue Broadway after college, and theater was my thing. So it just happened to be the recording agreement in the contract first, but I technically, legally didn't sign until I was 18, even though I started working on my album at 17.
That is so crazy. Like, just a bit of research that we've done on the early years, it kind of seemed like you were very much more focused on your dance. You know, you did ballet, you did tap, you did jazz, you know, the works basically. So I was kind of perplexed to see where the music side kind of emerged. And now it makes so much sense. You know, you're talking about your father doing it, and it's just, it seems like you've just been pursuing these paths from the very beginning, and that just happened to catch on first, right?
Yeah, That's how it is. I got into school for music, actually playing the violin. I was a tap dancer. My first job was teaching dance, and tap dance was my forte. I was a rhythm tap dancer, improvisationalist. You know, I'd performed with Savion Glover, Gregory Hines, the Nicholas Brothers. Started improvising at like 13 in New York City and getting gigs, and then became a dance teacher at 14 in my area. I mean, I was really advanced in that area for a girl. But I mean, there were so many things in my upbringing that always went back to music. There was a band over the house all the time. There were musicians rehearsing with my dad in the garage, the neighbors complaining every day. going to the recording studio with my dad as early as like 6 years old, I remember watching him record his records. And I come from a very musical family. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, my aunts, my uncles, on my dad's side, they all sing. And on my mom's side, you have musicians, so pianists. My grandfather, who's not here with us anymore, actually arranged for and wrote sheet music for every instrument in an orchestra. Wow, you know, so wow. There's so much around me It's just in my DNA. Record deal happened first.
That's how we see the path was destined. So let's talk about your very, very first single, because this was such a huge deal in America. It's All About Me. We need to talk about the music video, because I heard you styled and choreographed that.
Well, I designed the outfit in red. And I basically did a lot of sketching as this young girl who had artistic skills. My grandmother is a painter and an artist professional. And so I would draw in my room, and it was like my first side hustle in high school. So that actually I applied to when I did my first video. I made the sketch of what I wanted to see myself wear. And there was a seamstress there that looked at the designs and made it herself. Now, I don't know how to sew. I know how to stitch. But I saw it come to life, and there was some choreography that I did. Fatima, who worked with so many people, including Aaliyah.
Fatima Robinson?
Yeah, Fatima Robinson. She choreographed that video, and we collaborated on my solo stuff. Cisco did some choreography with the fencing as well. So we were kind of very deep in it as creative people.
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, like, for people that don't know outside America, like, they really need to go and watch this video. It's absolutely amazing. The fact that it made top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100 as well. I mean, not many artists can say they have that for their debut single. So what do you think made that song such a success?
Well, Drew Hill, who was also signed to the independent label out of Washington, D.C., they were like my family production house. We were all a team. And they worked with me on my very first album. But Drew Hill had already come out a year before in 1997. And they were the biggest thing ever in R&B music. And so the fact that Cisco was on my very first single as this newcomer female, everyone's eyes were directed toward this first look for me in my career. Well, how did that happen, first of all? Are they dating, secondly? Who is this girl with Cisco and Drew Hill in the video? How did she get that opportunity? How do they know each other? She looks like she's been doing this for a long time, you know? There was no fear, obviously, I have, but it was my first time into the marketplace. And I think all of those dynamics played a part in impact. It was a smart move for the label, because there was the Drew Hill fan base and Cisco, his fan base, that very, very much propelled me into a guaranteed space as a win.
Amazing. Do you still have that iconic outfit?
I do. And just 2 years ago, on its 20th anniversary, I did a cleanse. I did a challenge. I lost some weight and I fit into it. And I wore it on stage with Cisco.
Amazing.
When we performed this song for the 20th anniversary, I came out on stage at the House of Blues. Yeah, I fit into it.
What a way to celebrate 20 years.
That is a major throwback look. I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the determination we're all going to need after this situation. So look, that year, you also had two huge features. You had Ghetto Superstar, and then you had Take Me There with Blackstreet for the Rugrats soundtrack. And both of those were huge top 10 hits here in the UK. And that also kind of established you in your career as, when we look forward from here, you are the queen of soundtrack features. You know, there's so many amazing ones throughout your career. So Ghetto Superstar spent 10 consecutive weeks here in the UK in the top 10.
Wow.
How did you feel about those two big projects coming your way in the first place?
Well, you know, the fact that I'm around all of these hardcore rappers and I'm the soft, you know, singable, catchy hook, it was a nice balance doing Ghetto Superstar with ODB and Praz. Wyclef did the production. It was also a mainstream hit cover of Kenny Rogers, rest in peace, and Dolly Parton's Islands in the Stream, the melody for the Ghetto Superstar hook. And to turn this into like a hip hop record, who would have thought? Of course, the genius, Wyclef. He is definitely a genius when it comes to music. Very creative and very different, unique in his sound and approach. But the fact that it did wonders and it did numbers, it was a blessing. Mm. It became an international hit. It's probably one of the most requested or expected songs when I perform or tour worldly. And it's definitely a pop record. But the balance of Beauty and the Beast is all over that song, you know. I love it. And I loved working with the guys because they were just so fun, so outspoken, so outrageous. Rest in peace, ODB. We had a lot of great memories on tour, the Smoke and Grooves tour. Nothing but guy acts on that show. And here I am, this girl, you know, around all of these guys. But I learned a lot. And they were like my brothers and always protected me. But back to the song, it was already a hit before we covered it. And just awesome moments to start my career with.
What were your thoughts on the Rugrats song? Did you just think kind of like, what was this? Or was it like instantly an infectious hit to you?
You know, I grew up on the Jackson 5, and so doing Take Me There and then also being in the studio with Teddy Riley, who I'm a huge fan of on the production side, and he's an incredible performer too, to be there with this heavy hitter, hit maker producer and cutting my vocals, it was unreal. It was very surreal because everyone that I'd collaborated with so far, I was already a fan of. And of course, Take Me There is very reminiscent of ABC by the Jackson 5. And it felt really good to my soul, the chord changes, the inflections, the collaboration with Blackstreet, and then the balance of Mace as the rapper on the track. It was awesome. Then being the only girl again. But the video, I would say the video was so much fun. I was not a kid at that point. But my brother then became a fan, my baby brother, off of that song, because he was, you know, still very young and tuned into the actual cartoon Rugrats, which became a movie, which that song was the lead single for. So it was kind of cool to kind of bring some of my family members that were much younger than me on board the Maya train. Yeah. Like, yay, you're happy to see me sing.
I actually find it quite interesting, this Rugrats soundtrack, because for a teen star, as you were at that time coming out, they didn't really try to market you as too young. Like they, as far as I can tell, this is probably the only project that they went, okay, maybe she needs to kind of get the kids market and everything else. Like your first album is so mature, the lyrics and the beats and the harmonies, the vocals, like you would have never guessed that, you know, you were trying to be marketed to a younger audience. Did you feel that?
I didn't actually feel like I was being marketed intentionally to a younger audience because it was only one moment and it was appropriate for a specific soundtrack that did market to children. So that was the beauty of doing soundtracks. You could kind of fluctuate between genres, demographics and age, and it'd be received because we were fulfilling maybe or complementing what the story was all about. And so I'm here with guys that are older than me, you know, and I think maybe they felt, what is this? Why are we going to be in kids' cribs and playing with big toy blocks? Maybe they felt a little weird about it. I was having a ball. I'm like, I feel like a big kid again. We all loved it, but we didn't feel any pressure to be marketed to a younger demographic. It just happened. The synergy, the Teddy Riley link up.
That's super cool. So look, your second album, Fear of Flying, I mean, you know, you've had such a big start in 98, and I noticed you took a little bit of time in 99 and a bit 2000 to work on your second album. And this was the part that really impressed me. I was talking to Joel about this before. You took so much more creative control already with your second album. Like I read that you went in and you were across the mixing, the mastering, the recording, the production side. Like, I want to know, what did it feel like to be a woman in such a male-dominated studio space for you at that time?
Well, honestly, as a tap dancer and a hoofer, you know, which is not necessarily associated or wasn't at the time associated with women. It was more of a male dominated art. I grew up around guys. You know, I'm the only girl in my family as far as, you know, growing up with boys and being the tough tomboy, also the oldest. So my father kind of raised me like a boy because he knew there were going to be problems later on in life. And he wanted to condition me to be able to walk anywhere in the world, tough skinned, headstrong as a woman or just a female. And walking in those rooms was never uncomfortable. So art is really special to me. And I think just as a creative person, it was never from a place of control or being a control freak or ego. It was just wanting to make sure that the balance of vocals or percussion was right. And maybe this instrument needs to come up a little bit, or maybe I need to add something here. Mm. I'm not satisfied. I'm a perfectionist. And that's just a process of protecting your work, but also making sure that it sounds the best to your satisfaction so that you can just be proud of it while you're performing it or promoting it. That's all it is. It's just an extension of the creation of it and then the completion of it.
Yeah. And just being completely proud of your work and owning it from every step of the process.
Yeah.
But I mean, surely there's like no doubt that, you know, the studio atmosphere, especially in the music industry, is so male dominated. And, you know, there aren't mm-hmm. enough female producers and engineers even to this very day. So were there particular female producers or songwriters in the industry that you looked up to at that time?
Yes. Diane Warren was one of the songwriters and producers that I looked up to. She wrote so many hits for so many people.
Yeah.
But getting a chance to work with her was awesome. She has a very, very beautiful personality, but she's very confident in what she does. And I think that's always to be looked up to. Another one, Linda Perry, was an awesome songwriter. She's written for Pink and Christina. We've met in the studio before, but never actually got to work. But I loved her energy. I loved her bold approach to everything, including life and her own personality itself. And you could feel that presence, which I could say might be intimidating for anyone, woman or man, because she's just so solid in who she is and what she does, but very unapologetic. So it really just depends who you are, where you are in your life, how comfortable and confident you feel, and then how you express that to everyone. I admire those two women, but so many other women. You know, Patti LaBelle is a woman that has become basically the godmother of all of the ladies of Lady Marmalade. Mm-hmm. And she's just really instilled a lot of wisdom from her own personal experiences. And she's just this beautiful woman that is very confident, of course, on stage and off stage, but speaks to us in a motherly manner, just the sweetest person ever. So I think you can do it all and be both, whether you're a man or woman. It's just knowing who you are and obviously your art and the confidence that you walk that allows you to navigate properly through any profession, male or female dominated. You just own it and own you. And you'll be set.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You just got to show up and just be it.
Yeah. Be it, you know, but also own everything that you do and ask questions too. We don't all know. Remain a student, mm-hmm. you know, but also begin to master your art and all the skill sets as you are a student.
Well, it certainly seemed like you were a great student at this time, just getting involved and diving in and, you know, crafting your second album. You got to work with David LaChapelle for the photography and the visuals for that. I mean, we love the aviation themes and all that that was happening in the details. Like, did you have much creative control over that part too?
Oh, David's so cool. You know, I love collaborating with artists that have a vision. My vision might be something totally different.
Yeah.
And so in cases like that, when I'm working with an expert, we'll, of course, take a meeting. And they already have their genius idea thought out. I already have mine. We talk about it. We collaborate. And if I like their idea much better than mine, I'm going to let them take the reins, you know? And that's what happened. I really loved everything that he spoke on. And I've already trusted his vision because he has accolades and a long discography of photo shoots of fashion, of moments in his career that I was 100% comfortable with him directing me. And that's exactly what happened.
I mean, we love the album cover, that green leather coat. I read somewhere mm-hmm. that you asked for the picture to be cropped for the cover. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Was there a particular reason why you wanted it to look that way versus how the original shot was?
I think because there was so much space on the full version that the image gets lost on billboards or flyers or even in a store. But when you have something that is jumping out at you from
it's
afar,
just
there's
close.
Not so much background noise going on. And then at that time, I was only 20 years old, and here I'm in some hot shorts, short shorts. And I had something to say. Yeah. So I didn't want that to be the focal point to override the message either. And it was more timeless doing a crop shot, you know?
It's definitely a much more classic look, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's advice we could all had at 20. I think we all tried to rock the shorts. Me and David probably showed it off more, though. Could have been told to crop it in.
And I didn't mind, but maybe not for the cover.
Yes.
You know?
Very
time
wise.
And place.
Very wise.
Time and place.
So look, let's move on to the huge international hit, Case of the X. Now, this was a big hit here in the UK. It peaked at number 3. So we found out, and correct us if we're wrong, but this was originally a rap song that you'd overheard in the studio next door where producer Tricky Stewart was working on it. So tell us about the journey that that song took.
Okay, so I was working in Atlanta at a place called Red Zone Studios, and I was working with a producer called Shakespeare, who was working a lot with Destiny's Child at the time, and Candy Burris, I think that's her last name. Mm-hmm. Incredible songwriter, original member from Escape, the 90s girl group. And she was working with myself in the studio, just writing. And there's this beat that was playing next door. And we kind of all got up, went next door to see what that was. And that included one of the guys from the independent label that I was signed to in Washington, D.C. And we went crazy. There was a rapper working on it. So whatever happened when I went back to the other room was the conversation that created the foundation of that being my song. So some business had to be worked out.
Wow.
To hijack the beat. And that's how Case of the X was born.
You know, it's just fate, and you were meant to hear that beat and get that song.
It just happens like that all the time.
Yeah, I need to just start hanging out in studios more, overhearing people's sessions say, I want that song. So look, the video for this song is the definition of iconic. You know, you've got the Mad Max look, the choreography in the desert. What do you remember of this shoot?
I remember just rehearsing for like 2 or 3 days, solo and with the group. And I was with Tina Landon, an amazing choreographer who's choreographed for many people, but also Janet Jackson. And to be in her company was awesome, an honor. And she also let me take the reins as well and choreograph my solo part in the desert. So I did some working with her as well. But when we got to the Mojave Desert, which is where it was shot, I remember getting my hair dyed in the trailer and then getting like extensions put in after I had colored it to a lighter sand color. And all of that was done on set. Then it was time for wardrobe. The wardrobe was not lined. So we have all of these studs that are happening and then cutting us up underneath in pants on the side of our legs, but also here for me. So in the video, if you scroll back and watch, you're going to see some moleskin hanging out of my wardrobe because they had to line it on set in between takes. Because basically we're in the sun getting sunburnt. We have sand getting in our scrapes and cuts here. And we're having to do take after take. So it was literally hell.
Oh my
but
God.
I'm glad it didn't come across that way. But yeah, all of this was like cut up, scraped, and red.
I mean, yeah, you'd never tell. Blood. I mean, oh my goodness. I mean, watching it,
blood, sweat, tears.
Blood, sweat, and tears went into that video. Yeah, I mean, watching it, you've just got this fierce choreography. And I mean, you've kind of said it, but I adore a desert music video, but then B, the back of my mind is going, I bet that was just hot and exhausting doing shot after shot in that hot desert all day long.
Yeah, it was. But I mean, I didn't complain because I really loved the choreography. I love the stick and I just wanted to keep using it. I didn't want to be done with that scene. I felt like I got some frustration and aggression out. But, you know, literally, like you said, it's blood, sweat, tears plus sand. So I don't know if any of us were ready for that.
I have to say another highlight for me on the second album is Free. Notably not shot in a desert this time. I think we all learned.
Yeah.
This wasn't originally on the album. This stunning Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis track. How did it come about?
This track, Free, with Jam and Lewis, who also worked with Janet Jackson and so many others, it was, first of all, an honor to work with them. There was another soundtrack that Interscope, the label that I was signed to on the major side of things, was distributing, and they needed a song to represent, maybe a single. So they probably shot some other artists' videos as well, but it became a nice disco twist record for myself, and the skating in the video was my favorite part. It was a soundtrack single. It became that. And upon the success of Case of the X and some other collaborations that I simultaneously had going on, they decided to re-release this album after hitting platinum and put some bonuses on there. So Free was slapped on there after we released the song and video, and I was on a promotional run for the film as well. Yeah, people really loved it, especially my LGBTQ fan base, and it really solidified more of the dance direction that was the beginnings of that for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that video is so much fun. Like, I heard you came up with a concept for the roller skating and the theme and everything. Like, what was it like to bring all those elements to life?
Well, Dave Myers and I, you know, we had a conversation, and it's always just a creative conversation of synergy and feedback from one another. And he had this genius idea of obviously several looks, but different locations and worlds. And the dance segment of locking, but then also whacking was my idea. I've been working with this guy named Brian Footwork Green, who choreographed both. And then this great choreographer named Eartha, who did some of the jazz choreography in there. And they've been known in the business as just real experts in their field. The skating part I wanted to throw in there because the song felt so disco to me and Studio 54-esque. And that was really important because my mother is this huge skater and she's always loved roller skating on the four wheels, not the roller blades. Mm. And she taught me how to skate when I was like 3 years old. And that was a huge part of her life and still is. So it was kind of like homage to my mom. I thought she would love it. And she did.
Oh, that's so
sweet.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, mm-hmm. You kind of mentioned the disco element and everything. And from this video alone, I'm desperate for a Maya disco album. I'm just putting it out there into the ether.
Oh, yes. I hope you check out this song called Circle of Life. It's very disco. I love it. It's like house meets disco. And I'm a big fan of Donna Summer.
Amazing.
We have to have it.
We have to have it.
Oh, yeah.
We want a disco record and more.
And more, yeah.
It's coming.
And especially, like, you know, the gay clubs around the world. Oh, you doing that. Explosions in the best possible way.
Roller skates on stage.
You know, I had a conversation. There are two guys that are not here with us anymore. Andre Harrell and Prince. They both told me the exact same thing. They're like, disco for you is out of here. It's disco. So, yes, I've been playing.
Oh. Disco's having a revival in 2020. Like, this is the time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't wait to dance to that in the future when we can.
Me too. Can't wait.
We have to talk about Lady Marmalade. one of the biggest collaborations in music history. And to this day, we're all spending nights trying to recreate it with our friends. You know, if you've not recreated it with your friends or attempted to, then you're not living life. So how did that come about, and what were your initial thoughts on this project? Did you imagine it would become such a huge moment?
Well, I was contacted by Ron Fair of A&M Records. And once again, it was an Interscope soundtrack, which was the label that I was signed to. And they were kind of like sister brother partners with A&M Records. A&M at the time, I think Ron Fair was a producer on Christina Aguilera's album. He executive produced one, if not a few. And all of us girls were called up, you know, and chosen by the Interscope label execs. And this was for the movie Moulin Rouge, obviously, and the soundtrack single. And the process started with us all recording in the same studio, just background parts. And then we later laid our leads on the record. And they were edited by Ron Fair, who basically executive produced the full composition. But the original producers for the music are Missy Elliott and Rock Wilder. So you have all of these people involved behind the scenes, just making this composition great, first of all, sonically. After the song is edited, we learn our parts. And now we're in the rehearsal studio with, once again, Tina Landon, the choreographer, who is showing us all of the moves. Right after that, we're shooting the video. Gosh. You know, I don't think we knew what was in store. When the video came out, there was this huge buzz and impact and all of these requests. And we'd only performed the song maybe three or four times, two or three award shows and one at Wango Tango in California somewhere. I think we knew it was going to be huge. The way it became was when Patti LaBelle walked in the rehearsal hall and began singing it with us.
Wow.
And that was for the Grammy performance.
Incredible.
Know? And so we're like, hey, look, if we're performing with Miss Patti LaBelle, we can't not get a Grammy. You know? You know, so.
She didn't fly all this way.
Exactly. But the fact that we were just performing and rehearsing with her was just, we were all mind blown. So it happened. We received an MTV movie or video award or both, and then a Grammy. And it was just a moment that I don't think we ever had again, because you don't see that many females working together in the music business at once. First of all, it's very expensive. Yeah. You have to have a budget. Then to lock up already established artists and set them in schedule to coordinate everyone coming together at once for the recording, for the rehearsals, for the shows. You know, there's fittings, there's hair, there are makeup teams, there's a team for every girl. You know, it was a moment, an expensive moment, but I hope it paid off.
It did. You never get tired of it, you know. It's always a crowd pleaser. And it's a shame because we need more. Like you say, I've never really thought about that, of how huge the budget must have been. And we're robbed of these collaborations. Thank God we have this one, you know?
Well, thank God we have movies, because movies have budgets.
Yes, that's what we'll be pushing more for, yeah.
You know, soundtrack songs, soundtrack singles. But yeah, you guys, I know that you love to have fun. And there's this new app that Lady Marmalade is on. I just found out about it like 2 days ago, and all of my friends are hitting me with videos of themselves in the faces of every girl from the video. It's called Duplicate, like duplicate.
Right.
But it's Duplicate.
Well, look,
or cat.
When this episode comes out, we need to put me and David's faces on it. So be
I've
watching
seen
out for that.
On your
yeah.
Story,
it's so
hot. We're very
it's so
tempted.
Funny.
You'll have our faces coming soon.
Yes. You'll see your whole body, like in Kim and Christina Pink and myself's wardrobe. You get the whole wardrobe.
Amazing.
And you're doing the choreography in the video too.
Dreams can come true. I'll just be like, oh, but why can't I be like that in real life? So, look, let's move from one huge movie moment to another. In 2002, you were one of the Cell Block Tango girls in the Chicago film. And anyone who knows anything about musical theatre, the Cell Block Tango is such a huge moment. He had it coming. How was your Chicago experience?
The Chicago experience was amazing. I started off with an audition and they wanted me to improvise. There was no script. And so they gave me a scenario. The scenario was, is that, you know, I killed this person that was close to me, my husband. And I grabbed the closest object. It was a pen and I started smoking the pen. And then I got into this whole different character with this pen and it just kind of happened for me. And then I had to learn this piece just within like 10 minutes and then perform it to camera. Choreography, splits, turns, oh, rolls on the floor. I'm like, what is this? You're up for it, Maya. This is what you've been training for. This is yours. So it was so quick of an audition, but it was not the traditional audition. Mm. And not too many people ask me about the backstory of how it happened, but that's how it happened. And I got the call. They said, you got the part. I'm like, no way. Seriously? I was so excited. And I spent like 3 months in Toronto shooting because we also recorded the soundtrack together as well.
Wow.
We had to start the process from zero to beyond. Of getting fittings, of getting the proper shoes made. And because it's a period piece, all of the wardrobe was being designed custom to fit each girl. And there was going to be a lot of dancing and so many different takes as well.
Mm.
But I got to see a genius also work. And his name is Rob Marshall, who directed the film. He was involved in every single process.
Yeah.
The vocals, the vocal training, the inflections of how you pronounce your words, excuse me, in your monologues, the table reads, the choreography, of course. And there was just not one thing he missed. And he was as calm as ever. And it was magic, obviously, working with him. But then all of the superstars that came to work. Mm. Renee, Richard Gere, Queen Latifah, Catherine Zeta-Jones, the list goes on. So it was definitely a great moment to be a part of. And it was therapy as well, because I don't think I would have gotten that part if I weren't mad at my boyfriend at the time.
Method acting.
Honestly.
Well, look, and they were lucky to have you as well. I mean, your dance background, I mean, I'm sure, like, who else walked in the door and danced the way you can? No one, I'm sure, you know? Just while we're on Chicago, I do have to ask, you know, in a few years later, you were due to do your Broadway debut in Chicago, and then you had to cancel due to injury. What happened there? And, you know, are mm-hmm. we going to see you take on Broadway one day?
So I don't know why things happen the way they do, but I was meant to prop my foot up in a cask for 12 weeks while I recorded two independent projects. And so in 2008, I just started my independent label, but I did get the opportunity to be on Broadway in the role of Velma Kelly, which is what Catherine Zeta-Jones played in the movie.
Yeah.
So I trained, I learned the entire show. I'd been rehearsing and knew it like the back of my hand. 2 weeks prior to opening night, I did a tap dance project in California, and they had us rehearsing on a very, very hard surface that was not wood. And I had also been dancing in heels as well, kind of fluctuating between the flats and the heels.
Mm.
And I was doing this and training for a couple of weeks as well. Come time for performance, the night before, something snapped and I felt it. And I was misdiagnosed. They shot me with like a cortisone injection, steroids or whatever, so that I could get through the competition. It was called Secret Talents of the Stars on CBS. That was the first and last episode that they had.
Oh my God.
But I got through the performance, but there was this huge pain. And so I went home and I got diagnosed with something called capsulitis and corrosion of my joints. Come to find out, it was actually a foot fracture.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And the doctors gave me the orders that I needed to sit out and heal for the next 8 to 12 weeks. Mm. And so that interfered with Chicago. And the understudy had to step up and take my role. And from there, I sat in a cast in New York City because I'd already prepaid my lease so that I could do Broadway for 2 or 3 months. And I had my recording equipment there. And that's how my first 2 independent projects were born, in a cast.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So, of course, I would go back.
Well, we can't say Maya sits around and does nothing.
Yeah. You know?
When she's sitting around, she's doing something.
I even adopted a cat so I could have a friend. Oh. And I was terrified of cats.
Wow. So you fought the fear of cats and recorded 2 independent projects. So there is no...
Yes.
I mean, even when resting, you are just... doing all this stuff.
I would be so depressed if I were not doing something.
Yeah.
Because I'm a workaholic, but I like to be productive. So yeah, I adopted a kitten. I was doing this charitable work for North Shore Animal League, who are based in New York. They convinced me to adopt a cat. And he was so cool. He was my buddy during those times of healing. And yeah, I put out that first project in December of 2008, Sugar and Spice in Japan.
Amazing. So look, let's paint a picture for Broadway producers out there. Let's feed it to them on a plate. You know, what would be your dream Broadway role? What would we see Maya do on Broadway?
I would actually love to go back to Chicago and do Velma Kelly because I still know the show.
Yeah.
But I would love to play the part of Josephine Baker. You know, that's always been something that I've been in awe of. I've read one of her books written by her son. And there's a lot of people that don't know about her early life, the young Josephine Baker that made Josephine Baker, you know, and set the stage for her career. So something like that, that does include acting, dancing, singing, maybe songwriting. Yeah, but there's no actual dream project. My favorite Broadway show that I ever saw, I saw at 10 years old, and it's called Jelly's Last Jam. So that if they ever bring that back, I would totally want to be a part of that.
Amazing. Well, look, listen, Broadway, get your producers phoning Maya now. Because it's, I mean, I can't believe that you haven't been back yet. Like, you will be an incredible Velma. And I can't wait to see that happen on either Chicago or you're just destined for Broadway. I mean, so I can't wait to see it happen, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually what I wanted to pursue first. Like we talked about earlier, Broadway was always the first dream.
Now we're going to come back to the Naughties albums that you had. And obviously my personal favorite, Mood Ring. I was really actually quite intrigued to learn that you self-funded some of the early recording sessions for this particular project. Now, why did you decide to do that after having so much success? I'm sure, you know, everyone's throwing money at your projects. Like, why did you decide to take that path?
As an artist, you just kind of want to train just like an athlete would. We want to create all the time. And so if you have to wait for a budget to open up, which has so many different tiers to go through prior to getting in the studio when it's funded by someone else, my life just as a creative person prior to having a record deal was having access to a dance studio or a recording studio, even if it was bootleg equipment, so that I could do what I love to do. And that's how the ideas and the blueprints are birthed. And so as an artist, you have to know what you're going to say and what you want to say. And that requires time. And so, yeah, I would just kind of book the studio here and there to get my ideas out so that I could have a starting point of what I wanted the next album to be. And sometimes that means that you do have to fund it. Yeah. And I was okay with that.
I think it works in the end because I think ultimately that helped you become more confident to exec produce the album. And, you know, it's got your DNA all over it from the very get-go. Like, this is such a flavorsome album. Like, I could not even, just today I was cooking and I was listening to it. I was like, I can't believe she crammed so many different music genres in there. Like, was that just the natural course of just experimenting and writing and sessions?
I am from a musical family and I grew up on so much different music. You know, the rock bands of the 70s, the funk bands of the 70s, R&B, pop, disco, jazz. And then you have the traditional Broadway tunes from all of my theater life. You know, it's just all over the place for Maya. That's why it's called Mood Ring, because it's based on emotion. And I didn't feel that I could convey different emotions over the same type of production. Yes, one day I'm going to go out with my friends and have a freaking great time. Another day I might want to kill you, you know.
That's where Whatever Bitch comes in. That's a favorite on the album.
Whatever Bitch is like the fun song, but it's also telling someone off because I'm having my fun that you're trying to interrupt. But there's a dark record on there called Taste This.
I love Taste This. And take a little taste, taste of your own dirt. Taste this.
Oh my God, it's so dark. I'm like, oh my God, who were you back then? But I was just expressing myself and it does not align. It does not match genre-wise or even feel-wise because you're just going through the real ranges of emotion from one human being, which is all over the place.
Do you have a favorite on this album now when you look back at it?
Yes, I do. And my favorite, which I thought should have been the first urban street single featuring Lloyd Banks, is called Why You Gotta Look So Good. It was a really real record for me.
Yeah.
And that record really spoke volumes to what I was actually going through. And it's not a pretty record. It's just in your face. It's hip hop, but I'm singing over top of it. And that beat also belonged to a rapper that I hijacked.
It is the hardest hip hop moment on the album, but I just love the back and forth, you know, your bit and then his verse. It was just, it was telling a whole drama. Like it was a whole series right there.
Well, I was with someone that was just so fine. It was so hard to exit and leave the relationship because I would always forgive him. Because he would give me the look in his eyes, or I'm just like, I can't leave you because someone else is going to snatch that up, which is so unhealthy, you know, if they're not treating you right. But that's what a song is like. Jeez, I wish you were just not attractive so I can leave your ass.
It is so real. And
you're making
it
really hard. Yeah. You're making it hard for me. Yeah.
I'm going to jump back to the movies again. You were in this movie in 2005, Cursed, the Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson movie. Yeah. Now, this movie is infamous for its production, delays, recasting, rewrites, reshoots. So I just have to ask you, what stage were you brought in and how was the experience for you? Did you have to go back for all these reshoots?
I have no clue of what stage I was brought in, but everything was very seamless.
Oh.
I mean, I wasn't the first to die in the film. Because I wanted to make sure, as an African-American woman, that I was not going to be the first statistic, because that's usually popular in the scary movies. And so when people found out that I was doing it, they were like, make sure you don't die first. So I made sure of that. But it was so short of a project. I never had to go back to do a reshoot. So I think it was probably at the end stages when they had everything figured out already.
Best time to jump in. And not only did you didn't die first, but you also got an MTV Movie Award nomination for Best Scare, I saw.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I had no clue.
Aside from Broadway aspirations, what would be your dream film or TV role? Is there a reboot or biopic that you've always had your eye on? Maya, you haven't aged since you released your first song. You could play someone in their whole life.
Well, a lot of the fans have told me if Sade ever had a biopic that they'd love for me to play the role of Sade, which I don't mind. I find that to be a compliment. You know, if she's down with it, I would totally want to study everything Sade. Of course, I'm a fan. but her inflections as a performer, a vocalist, but her as an African, you know, she speaks differently with an accent. So I would definitely have to do some studying, but I think that would be beautiful. Once again, on theater stages or on the big screen, Josephine Baker was also another one that I find to be able to fit in the shoes of all around. So I'd love to do something like that as well. Yeah.
Amazing.
That would be absolutely sick. Now, I can absolutely see you as Josephine Baker. Now that you've mentioned it, I can't unsee it. So we got to see it.
But my ultimate, honestly, I'd love to play an assassin where I'm training for 8 months, you know, to do backflips and all kinds of fighting scenes, because I'm a dancer. A lot of the flexibility is still there, and my own stunts and tricks. I think that would just be something that I would be in love with. Anything that requires training in a new area that I can be violent in, of course, is nice therapy.
Yeah.
Because it's also make-believe, but it's badass. And so when I get to see women in those types of roles, I'm like, oh my God, I'm a fan for life. Yes. So I would love to do something like that.
That would be super sick. Look, we can't leave the music part of it without talking about the incredibly, how do we say this, lost classic that is Liberation. Because we love Liberation.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it could have had a really big moment for it. So how do you look back on that time? You know, obviously there was a big palaver with the record company leaking it in Japan, or it was released in Japan and then it couldn't be formally released everywhere else. Like, how do you look back on that time now with so much distance now and you've carved a new path?
Well, I mean, everything happens divinely, even though when it happens, it feels like the worst thing in the world. But I mean, I really wrote a lot of that album, probably 90%, and I did fund a lot of it as well. And scout my own producers and independently have a mindset of just wanting it to be right.
Mm.
So it did hurt, and it was very devastating when it got accidentally released after the release date changed. You know, Japan received it first, and then it leaked everywhere online. Because at this time, online in internet history, when an album technically came out anywhere in the world, the rest of the world would receive it with a leak on YouTube somewhere. So now it's in the marketplace and you can never extract it. Once it's in the hands of one person, it's going to be found somewhere else. And so that required the label to strip funding and say, you know what? It's out there already. We can't do anything with it. It's premature of a release. We weren't prepared to catch up with it. It has to be shelved. You know, so the physical copy got shelved and it actually never came out digitally or streaming wise, because when you actually technically turn in an album, now the producers are owed back end advances. I'm owed my back end money.
Wow.
And that's even more money legally that they would have to pay. So I just decided, you know, I don't want to spend too much time with the energy of a lawsuit or court. I'm just going to kind of go within for a while and go independent, whatever that means, which my lawyer advised, and just see what happens. And so a lot of things happened. Prince called me. I opened up for him at the O2 Arena 2 nights in a row.
Wow.
A blessing. Wow.
I mean, the Chicago thing happened on Broadway. Then obviously when the album leaked in Japan, they loved it so much that a local record label by the name of Manhattan Records contacted me when they found out I was independent and said, hey, do you want to do an album exclusive to the Japan territory? I'm like, sure, why not? I'll give it a try. And so they allowed me to do whatever I wanted, and everything that they released to the radio there went number one. So it was different. I felt like I wanted to please the fans everywhere, but I couldn't. So that experience just propelled me to start my own record label. I'm in my own studio right now where I created a lot of that stuff too. And I just never looked back because it's just been so fruitful, and I've traveled so many places in the world as an independent artist. But I mean, I love major labels too. It just has to be the right time.
Yeah.
That's all.
I think, you know, we've all learned so much from that time with how music works and, you know, with releasing and, you know, just working closer with technology. I think everyone's just much more up to speed now. And, you know, like you said, like this was a literal liberation for you because it opened so many doors. Yeah.
Ironically.
Right? Are there any songs in the album that you listen back to now that you just go, that's my favorite? Like, that's the one I really, really still want people to pay attention to.
Life is Too Short. That's
I love that song. It's
Walking
beautiful.
Out of Taka.
Yes.
Featuring Snoop. That was one of my favorites. I wanted that to be the first single because it was so badass again. there's another one called Nothing at All, which is more of a gospel song. And a lot of fans still love that song, the ones that have had a hold of it and have requested me to sing it and told me that they've cried and recovered or healed to that song. So, you know,
those magical
songs.
Yeah.
We love Walker, Not a Talker. And I'm sure you would have seen this somewhere on the internet that Lindsay Lohan covered it. Did she get your blessing? Lindsay, what happened?
It was all a surprise to me when it came out. But, I mean, Lindsay was also signed to Motown at the time. And so you have all of these records that are not in the marketplace, but belong to Maya, and she's no longer on the label. She left. But because they paid for the records and the production, they thought maybe it could go to use. That actually hurt really bad because I funded that record. I met up with the producer and I gave that producer a call. I reached out to Snoop. You know, I wrote the lyrics. And here you have this other artist, you know, cutting the record that I wrote, and all of that came out of me and my personal life experience. Nothing against the artist, but the way it was done, you know.
Yeah.
I let it slide. But that stuff happens in the entertainment business all the time. So I got over it and I just released a whole lot of other albums after that.
Yeah.
Onwards and upwards.
Would you ever re-record those albums on your own label and re-release them so you've got the masters?
Well, you can't because you would have to buy those masters first.
Oh, gosh.
And when you buy the masters, you can have access to the files. You know, I actually hit up Universal Music Group because they did do a re-release on the 20th anniversary of Fear Flying this year. And I'm like, some of these songs are really great, but I don't like how I sound as a young girl. And I would want to do a whole live version. And plus, I want to perform some of these songs as a grown woman now, but with a live band, and maybe even put them out in the marketplace, but a new upgraded version. And so I'm in talks with them, you know, to see how the business would work out, because there's some fans out there that want to hear these records, but I would want to deliver them in a new way now that it's like 20 years later.
Looking forward now, you are actually one of the very first teen pop idols in our minds that we saw in the 2000s to go independent, to do it consistently and so successfully for over a decade now. I think the bit that maybe some people feel like, oh, maybe it's not for me, is just how overwhelming it can all be. You know, you got to be across your budget, your videos, you know, your distribution, and on top of your job as an artist to create and to promote. So how do you manage all that?
Well, I'd stayed single for a long time because it required me. I don't have kids, you know, didn't have a man, was not engulfed in any relationship to deter me from my focus. And I was basically hands-on with everything. I learned how to engineer my projects so that I could record them at no expense. I have my own studio, so there's no studio bill. So right there, I'm saving thousands and thousands of dollars. And I also don't have to wait on anyone. So now I can perform in my PJs, you know, and record and write while I save a budget. But now it's about copying and pasting previous legal ramifications and language from contracts that already exist and becoming my own lawyer. So that now I don't even have to pay a lawyer sometimes.
Wow.
And learning the language, managing, road managing, choreographing, sometimes directing, but also building a team as well, because it does take a team to shoot a video. It takes a team to produce songs, and it's a lot of reaching out, a lot of explaining, independent budget, independent rates, negotiations, and just getting to it. It requires you to wear many hats. But when you love something, you find a way. I love music, but I also feel like I let my fans down, even though they don't really know the dynamics of what truly happened. I never really wanted to fully explain it because I never wanted to come across bitter. So I just got to work. And a lot of the world felt like I disappeared because the funding, of course, wasn't there for marketing and publicity. But it's not always meant to be big. It was meant for me to be able to empower myself and also be propelled into a new direction so that I could become the best artist for myself, but also for the world. And then when it's time to maybe revisit the major labels, but not as an artist, but as a label that does what labels do already, then you have the perfect marriage because you're, at the end of the day, basically preserving a budget for them that they don't have to spend anymore. And now we can just focus on radio. Now we can just focus on promotion and publicity or marketing. And ownership is a big thing that Prince talked about. And when an icon and a phenomenal musician, et cetera, that's been doing it for years speaks, I felt like I should listen. So that's kept me in my journey. And there were just so many blessings and so much fun that I had being able to release whatever, whenever, whether it was received on a big scale or a small scale, I've learned. And that was necessary just to empower me. So I've been to school in a way.
Yeah.
And now I can truly manage artists if I wanted to. And that's really awesome.
I was going to say, like, you would be an amazing mentor for young artists. Like, just hearing you speak just then, I'm like, is there a masterclass? Like, should we be signing up somewhere for tutorials?
I mean, there's so much more that I don't know. So I'm still a student. But as far as being able to put out project after project, I've mastered how to make projects. But doing it independently on no budget. Yeah. Mm. So I can teach some things, but there'll be a time and place for that too.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to achieve in this sphere as a music mogul?
Greatness. I'd like to achieve greatness. And I never feel that I've reached the point of giving the best of Maya just yet. But the most important thing for myself right now is to make timeless music, no matter the genre, so that it's everlasting and it speaks to people's souls.
Yeah.
There's always a time and place to have fun. There's always a time and a place to get ratchet. But I love it all. But also, if something were to happen to me, my approach in music is different now.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about when that casket drops, what do I leave behind? Even if my moment is after I've already ascended into another realm, what is it that you're saying? What are you putting in the universe? How are you helping people? And how are you contributing to this world? Is it significant? And that's the place that I create now, which is now why you have the record Space and Time.
Yes, I was going to say, this is all leading up to a very reflective and very current mood of how we're all feeling, you know, in light of this pandemic, and everyone's kind of, the world has kind of slowed down a little. And I feel like this is the healing lockdown bop that we need at this time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on that album for years now, in between other albums and tours.
Yeah.
But that's one of the next directions, because I'm working on two right now. Oh. Polar Opposite.
Is the other one the Ratchet project?
Maybe. I'm a Libra. I love balance.
Amazing.
But
so yeah, tell us a bit more about Space and Time.
Space and Time is basically the record of my life and everyone's life right now. Allowing yourself and giving yourself permission, guilt-free, to practice a little bit of self-care. That means shutting off your phone and devices. That means tuning out and tuning in within to be able to make sense and process what's happening, whether it's in your internal world, the external world, and getting in touch or at least centered so that nothing out here or other forces that are obviously ever changing in the world can bend or break you. Self-care goes a long way. What does that mean? What does self-love mean? We hear it all the time. It's not cliche. When I speak of that, I mean truly watching what you ingest from the dialogues and the relationships or the self-talk about yourself or even to the world and situations that occur in your life. There's never a linear constant. There's never just positive. How do we make sense of it? How do we react to it properly? How do we take care of ourselves and our emotions and our spiritual beings? It's such a confusing time in the world. It always has been. And it's before it was too chaotic. Now we have so much time on our hands. How do we make sense of it? How do we practice positive things? Mm. You know, there's yoga, there's exercise, there's group chats that are very healthy. There are tutorials online that you can take. There are documentaries to watch that are enlightening. But a positive mindset, positive self-talk, and staying optimistic in these very pessimistic, confusing times is my remedy. And taking it one day at a time as well, because we don't all have the blueprint to life.
And the video to it as well is absolutely gorgeous. Did you film that before everything happened, or did you manage to film that during this time?
Before everything happened, I was on tour and I sat at home on lockdown and quarantine for 2 weeks. And I got really depressed and I was gaining weight. The refrigerator was my best friend. And I just said, you have to do something. And that sparked the idea of the song. I think when you're an artist and you're not doing something for people, you start to question your own existence. Mm. And even though I cut that song in 2018, it just seemed appropriate for these times. So I contacted the producers first to release the song, which came out in May 29th. On May 7th is when I decided that I was going to shoot a video in my yard.
Wow.
And make sense of this lockdown, because the world was not open. A lot of the stores, everything was shut down, actually. Yeah. We were not supposed to have more than 6 or 7 people on a property at once. And so we all practiced social distancing and began shooting right in my backyard, and just wanted to be a very natural video, very at home. No wardrobe, no stylist, no hair, no makeup. I did everything myself.
Wow.
Went in my closet, you know, went to Target, and I wanted to be basic and relatable. You know, it wasn't about
really
anything
grounded,
else.
Yeah.
Really grounded, not materialistic, because no one's thinking about that stuff right now.
Yeah.
This is not the time. And so I just decided to keep it simple and to speak on how we were feeling.
Yeah.
How I was feeling, and maybe how the world was feeling.
The video complements the song so well with those restrictions. So it works, it all works in a funny way, doesn't it? So look, you were touring the UK right up until everything happened. You were doing this big, fabulous tour. What can you tease us with what you've got coming up this year and next year?
I don't have a clue. I'm not working right now. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening next as far as what I'm releasing. But I think you should know that there's another video that I shot in Hawaii, Costa Rica, part of Jamaica, that's being edited, you know. So that might come next. It's for one of the songs off of the TKO album. But as far as these next albums are concerned, I'm working on those. And so that's all you get. There's no release date set.
Okay.
It obviously has to be ready and right before I announce that.
Are we going to have anything that we can dance to in the future?
Always. I have an actual record that's coming out this year with a DJ that's doing dance music. And so I'll let you guys know when that's coming out.
Please do. I also have
a Caribbean feature with Movado coming this year as well.
Amazing.
So there's things in the works, collabs and all of that.
Well, Maya, you just said to us, I'm not working at the moment, but you clearly are.
working.
I'm not touring. Right.
Do you think we'll see you in the UK again or in Australia anytime soon? Obviously, we can't predict what's happening, but...
I don't know. A lot of artists don't know if the touring world is going to open back up again anytime soon. We're kind of in limbo. We don't know. But there's always virtual concerts, and I'm so down. I just did a Pride concert recently. It was cool.
Amazing.
I'd never done that before. I've done like commencement speeches for graduations.
Wow.
But virtual is the way. It's definitely a lot more cost effective for promoters, but there's nothing like a live performance. And I hope that I can come back to the USA, Australia, New Zealand. Sooner than later.
Well, look, I just have to say, you said briefly earlier that at one point you felt like you were letting the fans down. But I must say, from our point of view, it's quite the opposite. You know, you've created this amazing template. We've unfortunately seen so many artists fall by the wayside because of this industry and labels. You've become such a boss and a template, and you've actually made it so your fans are seeing more of you, the amazing projects you've released, the tours you've done. So you're actually, all this hard work, they've only benefited from it. So I just want to let you know that and hope that you know that, because you're doing brilliant work.
I hope so, because most people don't know.
We make sure people know. You've got your hardcore fans, Maya. They know. They know.
They know.
All we can do is keep making sure they know, which we will help with. So look, Maya, before you leave us, we are a Noughties Pop Music podcast, so we have to ask you, who are your top three pop bands or pop artists from the 2000s?
Okay, from the 2000s? Oh, goodness. Oh, man. Okay, so we're still in the 2000s, right? Or do you consider this to be the 2000s?
So to the end of 2010.
Yeah.
Oh, darn. Okay, Shakira.
Yes.
Britney Spears. Usher.
What a Fab Four.
Legendary.
I want to see you, Shakira, Britney and Usher on a project. That is what dreams are made of. Well, look, Maya, this has been amazing. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you online and where they can follow you?
Everyone can follow me on social media at MayaPlanet9. That's the number 9. And my website is mayamaya.com. If you want to partake in the vegan challenges, go to my website in the lifestyle section. You get a free starter guide. If you want a free video drop, I'm on the Cameo app. And I do virtual meet and greets on the Candy platform at Meet Candy.
Amazing. And look, space and time is everywhere, as are all your projects. So that's Spotify, YouTube. Everyone needs to go and stream it. Maya, thank you so, so much. Sorry we overrun. So thank you so much for sticking with us.
This has been such an honor, and thank you so much for your time.
An absolute honor.
Thank you, guys. You guys did a whole lot of research. That was awesome.
Oh, we've got no free time. This is all we do.
Well, that's nice.
We're single. Well, I'm single. He's not. I spend my time on this.
That's so refreshing.
Thank you.
That was really refreshing. Thank you. I had so much fun.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Have a great one.
Lots of love.
Thank you.
Love you guys.
Bye.
Have a great one. Peace.
All right. So thank you so much again to Maya, and a big thank you to Joe Daddick for setting this up for us. If this is your first time listening, please do check out our other episodes where we celebrate the icons of noughties pop music, and make sure you hit that subscribe button. You can follow us on all social platforms at Right Back Pod. You can follow me at Dr. Joel B on all platforms, and he is...
at lovelimmy_moodring_fan_maya_forever. I'm joking. It's just at lovelimmy.
hashtag justice for liberation. That has been amazing. And, you know, huge thank you again to Maya.
I'm just buzzing, Joel. I just can't believe we spoke to an actual Grammy winning artist on our little show. And she's so lovely and just so wise and just... I want her kind of just peace and clarity and her kind of wisdom. I adore this woman.
Even spent more than the designated time to us. That is so kind.
Queen.
She spent extra time with us because we had to ask all our questions. So look, Maya, thank you again. We can't thank you enough. Thank you again, Joe. David, thank you. I'm so happy we get to do this together.
So much fun to do it together. And sounds like she enjoyed it. So yeah. Guys, if you are managing or doing PR for any artists, I guess we are available, as Joel would say.
Available. look, there we are. Thank you so much for listening. Hit us up everywhere. Listen to the other episodes. Until next time. Bye.
Bye.